Today on Tributaries, we join the regenerative agriculture conversations of cultivated audio.
Whoa, here they come, the bison. And here to tell us about them is veteran bison rancher Lee Grace from North Star Ranch. Also with us is Claire Hill, the regenerative agriculture director for FAI Farms, running a newly refocused beef and sheep operation near Oxford, UK. Lots of transition and lots to learn. And artisan old world butcher Sebastian Cortez gives us the lowdown on how and what makes a great beef jerky. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio, June 2021. Lee, I think it's worth noting, perhaps for a historical perspective, that bison were more popularly being purchased as an exotic animal than for meat when you got rolling in the mid-1990s, and you chose a different path. What was behind that?
I think understanding sales and marketing, that's our background, is sales. We were with a Fortune 500 company at one point, both I and my wife, both of us having grown up on farms. She grew up on a hog operation in southeastern Minnesota, and then I grew up on a dairy farm about an hour south of where we live now. And both of us had dealt and seen the effects of the commodity market and realized that we did not want to be a price taker. We were not interested in being a commodity. And also knowing that because of my experience in the health club industry and the lifting world, that there were a lot of people looking for an alternative to chicken and turkey.
Right.
had somebody say at one point, you can only eat so much chicken in your life.
I agree.
And the bison was heart healthy enough that it would fit the bill for them. And a lot of our original customers were cardiologists and their patients, and then chiropractors and other people got involved as well. We didn't see a future in breeding stock. That's a very temperamental industry. We felt that if we did sell breeding stock, which we've done over the years, that's just gravy, but we needed to base our business plan on what the meat would sell for, because that was truly the salvage value that you would have on the animals.
Of course, considering the time, I really commend you for not buying into all of the testosterone and all of those things while you were doing that sport. And you carried that over into your drug-free and sustainably raised bison.
Yeah, I had many people say, in fact, there was a writer, he was actually a doctor, in one of his editorials said, if you're not man enough to take the drugs, get out of the sport. Well, that was pretty offensive to me.
I guess.
And I just decided that, you know what, maybe this sport isn't for me, but I'm going to give it a shot. I'll see what I can do. It stressed to me, and I realized at that point how important nutrition is. The drugs make up for a multitude of sins, and it's the same in the meat industry. Heavy grain diets will make up for a multitude of sins. Sins in management, sins in genetics, all kinds of problems and issues can be covered up with enough feed. In the grass-fed realm, you don't have that unnatural advantage that you can fall back on and, you know, just take a pill or, you know, just throw a bunch of feed in front of them. You can't
right.
do that. It's the natural genetics is what you've got to bring out of them. And what you have to do is figure out what is the best forage for them. Keep them in front of good grass. Early on, we had relationships with multiple grass-fed people. And we saw all kinds of operations from grass-fed by default was probably the worst because they really didn't have anything else to feed them. And the pastures were about an inch long at best, and most of them were barely above the roots is where the green was, and there was nothing above that. To where there was a few guys that really did a nice job, and they were doing the management intensive grazing and, you know, giving the pastures plenty of rest and, you know, letting that that forage regenerate. And you could see it in the animals. It's day and night difference. The one style where everything looks like a golf green, you're going to get lean grass-fed where there's no fat because there's not enough energy there to put fat on them. They're surviving, but they're not thriving.
Right.
And then the other is grass-fattened, and that's what we focus on, and that is making sure that these animals are moved regularly enough and put on new grass that they can express fully what their genetics have in them.
Yes, and I've seen pictures, Lee, of some of your pasture land, and it looks like a beautifully diverse gourmet salad. What did it take to develop that?
You know, Stan Parsons was the owner of Ranch Management Consultants when we first got involved. It was in the 90s. And I listened to him in Denver, and he made so much sense. We had this new property that we were just fencing in and getting going, expanding. And it had all been pretty much cropped, and a lot of bull thistle, velvet leaf, burdock, I mean, all these weeds, which, you know, not all weeds are bad. I'm not going to say that, because we do have weeds. We've learned to manage them. We don't want them to proliferate and crowd out all the grasses and the legumes that are out there. But it was bad. We had bull thistle 7 feet tall, velvet leaf 8 feet tall, and it shaded out everything on the ground. It was so tall. When I called Stan, I said, you know, I don't have the money to go out and tear all this up and seed it down right now. We were new into it. And I said, I really don't want to do that. If I have to, I guess I will. And he said, well, you don't have to. He said, are you okay with it looking rough for a while? And I said, well, how rough? He said, well, it's going to look pretty rough. But he said, if it gets too bad, just go out and cut it down. You know, just take a mower out there or something and just clip it and cut it back down. And that's what I did. When those bull thistles got 7 feet high and the velvet leaf got 8 feet high, and we went out and just cut it down with a mower and cut it down about 4 to 6 inches off the ground. And there was some grass starting to come. Initially, no grass, not even quack grew, because there had been so many chemicals applied that even the quack wouldn't grow initially. And after that first growth went through and we cut down all that stuff, then we started to see quack and a little bit of clover volunteer. Alan Nation said at one point in an article that he'd written about finishing beef cattle on grass, he said, we're not all lucky enough to live in the Great Lakes Clover Belt, and that's where we are.
All right.
Here, if the ground gets exposed, clover just shows up. We don't have to seed it. It's in the soil bank, and it takes off, and it does extremely well in our climate and in our soils. So what we've learned to do is you manage for what you want, not for what you don't want. So you manage the land so that it gives it every opportunity and the right conditions for all those grasses and legumes and the forbs and things that you do want, that they have a chance to really go and grow and proliferate through the pasture. And they'll outcompete the other stuff if you give them the right conditions.
Yes. Now, how do you figure numbers of buffalo per acre? It would seem it would be more about the quality of grasses and plants rather than actual acreage. Is that true, or...?
Well, there is a carrying capacity that you have to watch. If you've got two animals and 4 acres, you can manage that the same as you would 200 animals and 400 acres. You just have to get the grasses coming, and we try not to have more than anywhere from 2 to 5% of bare ground when you look straight down into a pasture. And we try to keep it as close to 100% as possible. And that's really what you want, because that retains your water. You know, you're maximizing on every square inch of that ground. And that comes through the grazing, either trampling or dropping manure or urine on the ground to just help fertilize and proliferate, and the dung beetles and all those activities and the microbes that are going on underneath. You just have to feed that stuff.
Right, yes.
Food supply there. And they will help build your soil. That's what builds your soil and your fertility up. We don't till anything. We've never just gone in and tore something up. That would be my background back in the 60s and 70s as I grew up in the dairy industry. I mean, you moldboard plowed everything.
Right.
And we just don't do that. They redid the intersection on the freeway. It's actually bordering the west side of our home place here. And before that, there was a culvert that the kids could actually ride four-wheeler through, sitting up on the four-wheeler, never come close to touching the ceiling of the culvert. And they actually even rode their horses through. They had to bend down a little bit to get the horses through, but they could ride through with their horses. That's what was there to handle all the volume of water that used to come off this watershed in this place when it was row cropped. 20-some years later, they came back to redo the intersection with the freeway, and they did a watershed check to see what the flow was for the water coming off the land, because they were going to replace that culvert.
Right.
Wanted to know what size. And there were times when that big culvert could barely handle the volume of water that was coming off,
beautiful,
off this watershed. And they put in, I think it's a 30-inch culvert, and that's all it needs, and it's never backed up.
Mm.
It handles all the water coming off. So from a probably a 6.5, 7-foot culvert to a 30-inch culvert.
Amazing. Wow.
Because of what the grasslands are doing of retaining that water instead of it running off.
I know. The rumors are true, aren't they? Sometimes unbelievably. Tell us about North Star Ranch, the geography, rainfall, acreage, and herd count that you have.
Geography is glacial till, as the soils are. We're right in where the glaciers came through. It's rolling. We're up in the northwest corner. We've got five major lakes very close to our home place. We grow two things very well in this place. That is grass and rocks. Because of the glacial till, we're full of rock around here. Another good reason to not till.
Right, right.
We've gotten rid of the ones that were damaging disc binds and stuff on the surface.
Yes.
And everything else just stays underneath. We don't mess with it. We just leave it, let it lie, and let the grass grow over the top and build soil over the top of it. Over these 20-some years, we've had some situations where rocks that used to be a problem are no longer a problem because the soil has built up enough around them.
Amazing.
That they're almost covered. The number of acres we run is close to 2,000, and it's leased as well as owned. We have a combination there, mm-hmm. and we run about 700 head. Some of it is a little lighter soil, so we have to stock a little lighter and give a little longer rest periods. But one of the rules of thumb that I think Stan talked about is that you don't see problems on a grazing operation until you exceed, I think it was 80 or 85% of the capacity, because then you don't have any margin for anything to go wrong.
Smart.
We operate with a drought plan in place. We don't stock right to the limit. We leave ourselves some room, and if they can't graze it, then we'll cut it and make it for hay and feed it to them in the winter.
Well, bison are so, gosh, they're just so hardy, and they seem just as self-sufficient. So unlike, I don't want to get into a comparison between cattle and bison, but what is your job like in keeping a herd? You don't have to artificially inseminate. You don't have to be there when they're giving birth.
No, your job description as a bison rancher on the day-to-day is you make sure they don't run out of grass and they don't run out of water. Those two things are what keep them happy. If you run out of one or the other, and heaven forbid you should run out of both, nothing is going to stop them from finding food or water. There's no fence that you can build that's going to contain them. They will find a way through.
I had to laugh. I saw somewhere where it said, bison don't do well with tranquilizers. And I thought, yeah, if you did a survey with any animal, you'd find that they'd probably have the same answer about that. I can just see them not letting a fence get in their way and not really appreciating the tranquilizers either. What's been your hardest lesson learned in this whole process?
Hardest lesson learned. I've had many of them. Art Stewart was a gentleman from Indiana who had been raising bison for quite a few years. And I had a conversation with him, and he told me to forget everything I knew about dairy cattle and things like that because bison are totally different. And that was true. That was some of the best advice I could get. I'd been away from farming just long enough I forgot a fair amount of it. But these are totally different animals. They're so much smarter, and I know beef guys will not be happy with that, but it's the truth. I mean, these guys are so sharp, and that's part of the wild side of them. The very thing I love about them, I hate about them, and that is that wild instinct is so strong. I've been to places where people have been raising bison, and they were former cattle people. Initially, they try to treat them like cattle. All that does is create a wreck. Either they or the people are going to get hurt. Mm. There's going to be a lot of equipment destroyed.
Yeah. What's your biggest herd health concern?
Probably parasites. Their Achilles heel is going to be parasites. Because of roaming vast areas of land in the past, they never built up or had to build up a real resistance to parasites. So it behooves us to move these guys often and not graze down to the ground. So we make sure that we always have fresh water in the pastures for them. You can't stop them from drinking puddles or rainwater. That just happens. I mean, they're animals. They're going to drink from that. But we don't put them in a situation where they have to drink out of a swamp that's drying up. And in our area, it's called liver flukes. It can destroy the liver on an animal if it really takes off. We fence out the swampier areas. And if there is ponds, we'll graze them when those are fairly full so they can drink from them. But when the water level gets down to a certain level, we don't let them back in there. Because the parasites are going to be in that very bottom, right when you get down towards the muck is where you're going to pick up the liver fluke.
Have you ever had a problem with a lot of them getting parasites?
We've had some issues.
And what do you do?
We had some death loss. It was early on. We were learning. I had a situation where we bought in some cows. When they came in, they actually were carrying a lungworm, and we had never seen it. They looked great because they were pretty much resistant to it because they'd grown up around it, apparently.
Right.
And they came here, and we had had some animals we'd bought in from Custer State Park, and we put them all in the same holding paddocks because we quarantine animals when they come in just to make sure everything's good. There, you know, no injuries show up or anything happened. And when they are calm enough that we can walk into the pen and they don't tear off for the far side of the pen, that's when we feel comfortable turning them out into the general population in the big pastures. Because then they've kind of relaxed enough that they're thinking and not just freaking out.
Right.
We lost several of those Custer cows from the lungworm, and I'd done a fecal test, found out what it was. I looked to see what could I treat them with. I will not let an animal suffer for the sake of saying it's organic. It's not going to happen. If that's what we got to do, I don't want a part of that.
Right.
So we will treat animals that show clinical symptoms and we have true, real issues and we know what they are and we can specifically treat for that. So I checked into a wormer. At, yep, lungworm was on the list. I treated with it and two more died. I'm like, what the heck? So then there was a study that came out on the product and a parasitologist from University of Montana had just done an efficacy study on it. And I thought, okay, this guy should know. And I called him and talked with him. And I said, you know, who I was, and I was dealing with parasites and bison. And I said, I just, you know, used this product and it didn't help. It didn't seem to turn it around. And he said, well, what was the parasite? I said, lungworm. And he said, well, there's your problem. I said, what do you mean? I said, it's on the label. It says it's effective. Well, it's only minimally effective. If you've got a heavy load, it's not going to touch it. Okay. So at that point, I learned to become much more discerning and digging deeper into some of these treatments. And we're very cautious as to what we use. And we do fecal tests to make sure exactly what we're dealing with if we have an issue.
Right.
And then we look to see what is the most effective against that parasite. And we've had herds that from the time they're born till they are processed at, you know, 24 to 36 months, they don't get a wormer at all. And then we've had ones that do. Each year they end up, egg count is too high, and it's going to start to affect their health. So then we'll treat them, bring it down. Usually that happens when a little bit more of a drought situation.
Right.
We end up keeping them in pastures, moving them too slow, just to try to give more rest to the pastures ahead. Because the parasites are in the first 4 inches off the ground is where they live in the grass. Without a doubt, that over the years has been our biggest challenge. We've got it now to where it's really a non-issue for us.
Right. It's amazing.
And mostly through management, grazing management
is
really the key tool you have.
Yeah, it sounds like it's amazing. You know down to the inch of where they live. That's great. Do you continue to buy bison to increase your herd? Is inbreeding a concern ever?
What we do is we hold back our heifers and we bring in bulls from the outside. That's the easiest way to do it. Otherwise, if you keep your bulls, you got to change out all your heifers. And bison are a long-term investment. You know, your average cow is going to give you 20 calves in her lifetime. The herd here, the small herd here at home, they're well into their 20s and still calving every year. They don't miss. But bulls, even if you have three herds, by the time they're 10, you've got to rotate them out or you're going to get granddaughters, great-granddaughters coming back to the sire of the original lineage. And we just don't want to get that close. I know some people do, and some people line breed. But I just find that you outbreed like that and you get a little bit of a hybrid vigor out of them. I really like to introduce new blood. And we've also learned to be very careful where we buy our bulls from.
I was just going to ask you.
Not all bison are created equal.
Right. I was going to ask you what you look for in buying a bison or a bull.
First thing we want to know is what is the grazing program they've been on and the raising program. If they have seen corn or barley or any of those hot feeds, I won't touch them. Their guts are really set up for failure in a grass program. Because when you introduce those starches, you lose your cellulosic bugs in the gut, and you go to the starched bugs, which is a very quick transition. But to swing back from starch to cellulose, it takes about a year for that gut to rebuild those cellulosic bugs. And a year's loss of production time is not good. And you'll see it in the bulls that have been fed and pushed to look big and beautiful for breeding stock. And I've done it. I bought a bull, brought him home. He was looking fantastic. And a year later, we got him back to the weight he was the day I bought him. He came off from corn, even though the guy said it was not that much. I found out later what he considered not much was a whole lot
too much.
More than what I considered not much. Yeah, and it changed the rumen over. So the bull just fell apart.
Right. Oh, man.
And he finally came back, and he did kind of turn around, but he had a short shelf life with us here. Our best breeding bulls are coming out of Canada. Their environment is very similar to ours. Corn is pretty rare. It's not as rare as it used to be. And with this many years in now, and I've judged the Canadian Nationals breeding stock show and sale for bison, so I've gotten to know a lot of the producers, and I know who feeds heavy and who doesn't. If somebody just gives them a little bit of oats here and there, that's a pretty easy transition back to an all-forage diet of all, you know, grass and stuff. But once the corn and the barley goes in, like I said before, it's really hard on them. That's what we look for, and there's a few guys up there that have gone almost entirely to grass, which when we did a presentation in about 2006 or 8 at the Canadian National Conference, we were asked to come in because we were so novel in the industry that we were doing 100% grass-fed, grass-finished.
Right.
And everybody's like, well, how can you do that? I said, well, the same way you can do it.
Right. Good for you. Good for you.
But it took a while for them to catch on. And now there's some younger guys that are coming up, and they're seeing the error of the old ways.
Right.
And one of them is a young guy we just bought a bunch of yearling heifers from. And they've gone to all cover crops and grazing. Their animals graze 365 days a year in Manitoba, Canada.
Lee, you also have a full meat center. Tell us about Zero Stress Field Harvest, just a little capsule.
Sure, sure. Well, we got into the meat processing business because we outgrew the processing plant that was in our area. They just couldn't take any more animals, and we needed more because demand was there. So we tried a different plant. That did not go well. I came home after being there about 6-8 weeks and told my wife, I said, if we can't do a better job in this meat business than they are, we don't belong in it. And we had been doing field harvest for a lot of years. The first ones we did were field harvested. As the numbers grew, we went to a point where we did a trailer shoot at the plant for a very short time frame. And that was because the state was kind of mandating that for us. And then we got all kinds of complaints because the kill plant was in a small community and the neighbors didn't like rifles going off in town Thursday morning. So we leased land just outside of town and took the animals out there. It's the right thing to do. Not everybody can do it. I get it. And we've had people calling from all over the U.S. and Canada. How do you do this? How do you get to do it? Because there's regulations in some states where it's just absolutely not allowed.
Right.
But we're lucky enough here that Wisconsin allows it. And what we've done over the years now is we've got 74 acres at our processing, our butcher plant, and it's all fenced in for grazing, so we rotationally graze them there. Three of the pastures have 8-foot-high game fence around, and the other three are just 6-wire high tensile fence. For our animals that go over there, we can put them in the 6-wire high tensile and feel comfortable. One of the things Art told me, Art Stewart, I talked about earlier, the last question I had for him was, Art, can you sell the meat? He said, you'll never go fast enough to keep up with demand. And that's exactly what happened to us. We have never been able to go fast enough to keep up with demand. We'll process about 400 head of our own each year, but this year we'll do close to 1,800, I think, is what we're going to process this year in total.
Amazing. Good for you.
And we'll do about 600 to 700 elk, and then we got beef in the other ones, too, but the field harvest came about because I just felt that that was the best thing we could do for those animals, and it was legal for us, and they don't like being handled. The stress level goes up. Their adrenaline kicks in. Then you get the cortisol afterward, which is the off taste and the toughening. That's the residue of the adrenaline.
Yes.
And that takes 48 to 72 hours to clear, depending on how stressed the animal was. So what we do is we'll bring animals in. We like them at least 3 days in advance of the harvest date, where they'll come in and they go into these pastures with a lot of times the grass is so tall you can hardly see them when they come off the trailer and go in. There's water, there's mineral, and they're in these pastures. They're not real big because I don't want to be chasing them all over. And I just go out with a tractor and a rifle, start to slowly drop them. If we have new inspectors or anybody there to help me, I have to teach them, think like a bison, move like a bison. Don't look straight at them. Don't walk straight at them. If you got to walk towards them, put your eyes on the ground. Use your peripheral vision to keep an eye on them. And just walk slow. No running, no jumping, no hollering. And they stay super calm. I usually drop two at a time. I can pick them up with a tractor and haul them out. And as I'm shackling them up, the rest of the herd will move to me. A lot of times they'll stand no more than 25 feet away. Just kind of watch, what am I doing? You know, what's George doing laying there? And I'll pick them up, haul them out, take them up front. The guy that helps me then takes them from there, weighs them, and then brings them up to the back of the plant and rolls them in on the skinning cradle. And one-shot kill is critical. That's actually mandated by state. And what you're shooting for is the obex of the brain, which is the brain stem. And when you disrupt that, it lights out through the whole body. The first lady that came and did our animal welfare-approved harvest, after it was all done, she said, you know, when I heard that I was going to do a field kill, she said, I'll be honest, I was not very happy. I was really kind of dreading this trip. And I said, really? She said, yeah. So I've been to some field kills back home, and none of them went well.
Oh.
Yeah, and she said, after being here, I'll be honest, I can't imagine a better way for these animals to go. And she actually wrote that in her report and right. gave us the ability to quote that if we ever wanted to on our website or anything.
Right. Just hearing your whole story with all of this, Lee, I can't help feeling that there's such a poetry and even a romance in what you're doing, because I think you were attracted to the bison because of their strength and their history with America.
It was. I read a lot about the Old West. I used to think I was born 100 years too late, but...
You know, no, I think you were born on time.
It's still okay. Yeah, I just love reading about Lewis and Clark and all the Old West, and bison were such a big part of that. And I didn't realize you could own them. I just thought zoos and state and national parks were the only place they could be. And then Mary's brother told me about Blue Mountain State Park in southwestern Minnesota having a surplus auction for bison they couldn't carry on their range through the winter. So we kind of checked it out 1 year, and then the next year went back, and we bought our first two from there. Yeah, they are absolutely incredible animal. I know Mary's brother, my wife's brother, grew up on the same hog farm that Mary did. And when he had his animals, one of the comments he made after being in it several years, he said, you know, when we had hogs, I couldn't wait to get away from them. Mm-hmm. He said, with the bison, I can't get enough time with them. Just sit out in the pasture and listen to them graze. Tear the grass and chew and listen to the babies talk to the moms. And it is such a peaceful thing.
Nice. Well, Lee, what is your favorite bison cut?
It's a kind of a toss-up between a tenderloin and a ribeye.
All right.
I'll tell you what I eat most is the burger. I am absolutely a sucker for a medium-rare burger smothered in onions and mushroom. We recommend medium-rare. The meat is so dark because of the iron content in it. It's so much higher in iron than beef. It's almost a purplish color to it. In grass-fed, all you've got is moisture, and you don't want to send that up in steam and take that out of the meat.
Right, right, exactly.
So that's
right.
Where the medium rare is really true. And even with the steaks, you don't really want to go beyond medium rare.
To hear the conclusion and for anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And podcasts are on the usual platforms. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.